Joining us on the line now is Dr. Anne Wolbert-Burgess. She's a leading forensic and psychiatric nurse who worked with the FBI for over two decades. She's currently a professor at the Boston College Cornell School of Nursing, where she teaches a graduate course in forensic nursing. She's received countless honours and accolades, including the Living Legend Award from the American Academy of Nursing. Her book, A Killer by Design, Murderers, Mindhunters, and My Quest to Decipher the Criminal Mind, is a behind-the-scenes look at the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Oh, thank you very much, Anna.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to work for the FBI, can you?
Yes, by basic training, I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I had just finished my doctorate and had joined the faculty at Boston College and was getting into a new research area, which was on rape victims. We knew that was going to be a problem here in the United States. And so a colleague of mine in sociology, Linda Holmstrom, asked me to join her, which I did. And over a year's period, we saw 146 people that came into the Boston City Hospital with a complaint of rape. And we wrote those findings up, and it was the article in the American Journal of Nursing that caught the FBI Behavioral Science Unit's eye, if you will, because they were just starting to train their special agents in rape investigation, and yet they didn't have much information on the victim. Of course, they had information on the offender. So they invited me down, and it was during my trips down to lecture to the FBI agents and other law enforcement that they wanted to do some of their own research. And it was in the area of sexual homicide. And so I helped them with that. And the result is how they would profile a crime by going to look at photographs and so forth, but to learn about the victim. So that was the birth, if you will, of the book, The Killer by Design.
Wow, amazing stuff. So were you able to see patterns then when you were researching initially during that time? We're talking the 70s, aren't we?
We're talking late 70s, early 80s. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Were you able to see a pattern in the people who were committing these crimes, the rapists and the murderers? Were you able to see patterns in their behavior and the kind of people that they were?
Yes, that's exactly what we did. And these patterns, they would initially, when they would go to a crime scene, they would separate it into whether it was what they called organized. In other words, there was very little clues. It's very hard for them to determine who might have been the killer. Or they were disorganized, which were just the opposite. The killer would have left clues or left information which would describe him. So by being able to break into those two patterns, we then further went down and looked at the behavioral characteristics. And so what the agents can do is to estimate very closely the age, the education level, whether the person was working, who the person might have worked with, lived with, things like that, that when you gave it back to the local police, were able to then match it to a level of suspects that they had. Mm. So that was very, very helpful at that particular time to identifying a number of what we did was had 36 serial killers in our study. And from those 36 is where we identified the patterns and the characteristics.
And the subject of crime and serial killers is a very, dare I say it, popular subject to be turned into TV shows and films. And I'm sure you've watched many police dramas and procedural dramas and films and things. Do you ever watch, obviously there's different degrees of quality, I guess, over the years, but do you ever watch any of these things and think, oh my goodness, that's not how it would be done? I mean, how realistic are a lot of these shows?
Well, I certainly do, and it is kind of fun to say, well, where did they ever come up with that idea? But then on the other hand, several of the TV shows have been based on the work that was done. At the Behavioral Science Unit, Criminal Minds, which is a very popular show here, certainly the Netflix Mindhunter has been fairly successful. So that in many ways, we were kind of pleased that they were able to talk about our the research we did, especially on the victimology. That was my role, is to really help them understand the victim, because that's all they usually have when you go to a crime scene where it's been a murder, it's your victim. So they get into, well, why was she targeted? What were her characteristics? How was she killed? And things that would then you would take to try to match to the characteristics of the killer that we had been working on.
It seems to me, thank goodness, that there has been, you know, when we look at serial killers throughout history, I'm struggling to think of one in recent years. I'm talking in the last maybe 15 years or so, let's say. Please correct me if I'm wrong here. But, you know, we think of people from the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, certainly in the UK, but I'm also thinking of people in the States as well. Do you think the kind of advent of technology and all the tools that the police and the scientists have to be able to trace killers and people committing these crimes, do you think that has been some kind of deterrent for these guys?
Oh, I do, definitely. Certainly DNA has made tremendous inroads to, and it's not necessarily to find the killer, but to what we say, exonerate some of them, that the people that they might have thought did it, and there's no match. That's a big help for the person that's been a suspect. So DNA has been very helpful, but also we've changed in some of the techniques. Now the internet is a huge way that persons that want to commit a crime can lure a victim. We spent a lot of time of warning people. I've had a number of cases where the internet has been used, not necessarily for murder, but certainly to get access to a victim. So in that respect, there's been some changes in the way in which crimes are committed. But there's still the other, I think, important point is we'd like to think that because we have these techniques that we're stopping killers faster. And that's a project I'm looking at now, is how did the ones that got away with so many murders, what can they tell us of how they did? How did they put it over on the police or whatever? So that's an important area that we're going to have to go back to the killers and ask them that.
Yeah. And I know you were one of the first female consultants for the FBI, a very male dominated field. How did that feel at the time?
You're right. It was a little unnerving because it was all male down there. But then on the other hand, don't forget here in the States that being a nurse, we were constantly confronted with male physicians that we would interact with. So to some extent, I had enough experience with that. But certainly law enforcement was a new experience. But they were very, very understanding. And I think the other thing that worked for me is that they needed the information. There was no way they knew about victims. And so because of the study that I had helped with, that was they needed that. And so I didn't have much trouble in terms of giving my opinions whenever victimology came up.
Yeah. Oh, good for you. And the idea of getting inside the mind of a criminal, I think gone are the days, I guess, where people believe that criminals are just bad people and normal people are not bad people. I think most people know that things aren't black and white in terms of, you know, bad people and good people. Have you found yourself over the years through doing the jobs that you've done and speaking to criminals kind of feeling very confused, not understanding, but well, yeah, I guess understanding how and why these people have committed the crimes?
Well, that's such a very interesting road to kind of explore. At the time when the interviews were being done to the with the serial killers, many of them would say they didn't know why they did it. And so we didn't know whether that was just something they were trying to put over on us or what. But over time, I have kept in touch with some of them. We were able to do telephone calls to prisons.
Wow.
And I'm just... Yeah. And I'm just thinking of one who said, you know, he says, I've really had a chance to think about what I did and why I did it. And he says, I really understand a lot more now. So I think that's a positive, not that we would ever want him out necessarily, but at least he can help us with what was going on in his mind. And we did learn that the fantasies that they act out start very young. And once we were able to talk with them about it, that gave them some insight on what the origin, if you were, was of the fantasy that they were acting out. Not all of them had fantasies. Some would be much more impulsive and, of course, commit a very impulsive kind of a murder. But I think that we still have a lot to go with to understand more about why they do it. Because then we might be able to stop it. If we know that this starts so early, you know, young boys primarily, to look at some of the behaviors that they have and get some intervention, that may have stopped a lot that would have gone on into that route. We still have a lot of murders here in the United States. I don't mean to diminish that, but I think we have learned more about preventing it in the behaviors that are really worrisome, distressing behaviors in teenagers that need to be attended to.
Yeah, there's sometimes been patterns over the years, hasn't it? When you've looked back at the childhood of serial killers, maybe they were really cruel to animals. Maybe they killed their own pets. They were bullies at school. They used to beat children up at school. You know, there's these patterns. Obviously, not every child who behaves like that is going to become a serial killer, but often you can take it right back and see, wow, maybe the signs were there.
That's right. The other thing is they get teased. I can think of several who are very teased and put down and humiliated. And that could be within the family or that could be with their peers at school. So, again, we need to do a lot of education to help out people who come in contact with young people not to do those things. They don't realize how sensitive some people are to the slightest kinds of statements that are made about their behavior. So
that's interesting, isn't it? So it's not just the bullies, it's the people who are bullied that can end up kind of turning on people.
Oh, right. In other words, sometimes it's the teasing that then turns them into the bully so that they can be in control.
Yeah.
Control, of course, is a big, big factor in any type of crime. Once the offender has control, it's very difficult for the victim to extricate from the situation.
Mm. And have you met a lot of criminals who just seem to have no remorse afterwards? Not only are they not able to explain why they did it, but they don't really care that they've done it.
Yes. And that would be pretty much your pure psychopath, if you will, that they really do not care about their victims. What some of the serial killers seem to do is that they were getting more of a thrill from getting away with what they were doing and putting it over on the police, because you can imagine the community is really panicked when they have, especially a child or an older teenager that is killed. And so that you have to be aware that that may be part of the what they get out of it, if you will, rather than just the killing. But it's more that I have the whole FBI or I have all of the police looking for me. Mm. We certainly had several of those personalities, yes.
Yeah. And do you normally find that the people like that, that fall under the psychopath umbrella, I guess, tend to not really have any family or loved ones in their life or not necessarily?
I would say more that they had family members that they weren't supportive of them and they didn't seem to care about them. And that was very, very important in the, there you go, in the upbringing of the child, that they not have the love and the support, or the sibling rivalry could have been so keen. But that I can think of several killers where that was a prominent feature.
Mm. I'm fascinated by when you said that you've kept in touch with some of these guys. Obviously, I'm not going to ask you who or whatever, but why did you decide to do that? What was your...
Well, I had put so much time into... These were cases where I would have... I really had put a lot of time in on it, and I just wanted to know how they were doing. We try to keep track of it. Some, of course, died in prison. Some were put to death. But those who weren't, I've got three that I really do try to keep in touch with at least once a month, just to, you know, just to say, how are you doing? What's new? That kind of thing. And letter writing is often done with between persons that I've worked on the defense for. So I always am intrigued with how they adjust and how prison is for them and what it's like, because that's their life now. And they know that they're going to, many of them know that they will be there until they die. So what is that like for them? Mm-hmm. That's what I try to find out.
And there will be people who would question why you would do that, you know, why you would care, if you like, about someone who's done something or maybe even multiple things that are so horrific, you know, raping and killing people. Do they deserve to have someone caring about them? What would your answer be to that?
Well, I go back to what you originally said when we started talking, is that these are human beings. They have certain rights, if you will, and why shouldn't we know how they're doing and how what we've done to them, if you will, put them in prison, whatever the sentence is, how that is for them, because we should be constantly, I think, evaluating our work. And there's always the issue of, should you let them out, you know, when they come up for parole? And this all keeps information available for parole board to consider. You know, mm-hmm. have they been a good inmate? Have they done with their, have they stayed within the rules? Because obviously they broke one of the major rules of a society when they killed someone. So, and this isn't because I necessarily, I just feel that there should be some support there so that they don't do anything terrible in prison. You certainly don't want them killing in prison. So I think if they know that there are people that are interested in how their life goes, that might be very helpful for them.
Mm. And have you found yourself feeling empathetic towards some of these people?
Empathetic in terms of how their life has been, and empathetic as if they are, if you will, behaving themselves in prison, because that certainly is important. But not sympathetic, but certainly empathetic, yes.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? There's so many questions around all these emotions that they can be going through. Obviously, the families of the victims will be going through for the rest of their lives. You know, there's people that would view criminals, oh, you know, lock them up and throw away the key. You know, they don't deserve any kind of friendship or compassion or empathy from anyone for the rest of their lives. And then other people realize that the power of not necessarily forgiveness, that's a strong word, depending on where you're coming from, but how much more you can get out of people and society for showing them some empathy.
Right. And I think that's where people can divide as they wish on that whole issue. But I think that it is something that we should talk about, we should think about, of what does that say to us as a society? If we certainly have respect, and they have respect. What I try to do is make sure that they have respect for the victims' families. Yeah. Absolutely. And is usually part of in the sentencing, where they are allowed to give a statement about their remorse or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's when they don't show any remorse that the parole board is certainly not going to look favorably upon them if they are in any way eligible for parole.
Yeah.
And many of them, of course, are sentenced to death here. We have death penalty in many of our, about half of our states.
Mm. And do you agree with that, the death penalty? Do you think it makes sense?
I think it makes sense in some cases. You certainly can understand how a jury would come to that decision. I always think of that when I testify from a defense standpoint. I feel that the jury has the right to hear any kind of information that might make a difference in their decision, whether it be, you know, the death, life, or whatever. Those are usually the only two options you have here in America when you have a murder. So, and how they spend their time in prison. Do they contribute? There's a lot they do in prison. It's its own little community. So do they make it easier? Do they get advanced? Do they? I've got one that I'm talking to. He was loved baseball, and he is organized for the prison in that particular state, ball teams, baseball teams. So that's a positive. There is something that is being done for them, and they do compete. And that's, I think, a good thing that he's been able to do to take his interest and still apply it where he is in prison.
Yeah, I've seen other things. I'm not sure if they do it in America, possibly, but certainly in the UK, to do with cooking, where they teach the inmates how to cook, and they set up kind of pop-up restaurants either in the prison or maybe depending on the prisoners, you know, taking some of the prisoners out to other restaurants, and they serve members of the public, teach them how to, you know, serve food or cook in the kitchen, which has been shown, you know, to be really positive.
Excellent. Yeah, and one of our other serial killers had a very very deep, fine voice, and he spent his time helping reading books for the books that go to the blind, the audio books.
Wow.
And so there's a very positive, I think, contribution that he made. He used I thought that was very good.
I remember reading an article once all about forgiveness, and it was talking about families who had lost loved ones to murder, so that their sons or their husbands had been killed, and they had all obviously been through a real journey of grief, and they'd all come to the point where they were able to either visit the killer in prison, or look at a photograph of the person who'd killed their loved ones and just say the words, "I forgive you." And it was so powerful, just those words. And they, the way that they were able to kind of have some sort of closure by saying those words were just amazing.
That is. That, of course, puts the victim's family in control.
Yeah.
They now have control, has taken it away from the killer. So that's a very positive, very excellent example. Yes.
Mm. And when you in the book, are you talking about, I know you're talking about specific cases. Do you give names of specific cases?
We do. Yes. In Killer by Design, they are named. Yes.
And any that we may have heard of?
Well, because they were at trial, and anything is once it's in at a trial, it's public information. Yes. Yeah, so we did John Jobert. We start the book off with that. John Jobert had killed two young 12-year-old newspaper boys. And later it was learned that he also had a previous murder of an 11-year-old, and he was executed. But he, John Jobert, very interesting background. Then we have certainly have the Brian Dugan, who killed, there was a double kidnapping of two little girls, and one was able to escape and was able to give us some pretty important information on the killer. So that case is there. Ed Kemper, that's a very familiar one, I'm sure. Ed Kemper, we have a rapist who had many, many victims, and that was Barry John Simonis. He's in the book. We have a case of I'm trying to think. Monty Rissell is another one you may have heard about.
Yeah.
So those are some of them.
And did you enjoy putting the book together?
I enjoyed it because I had someone to help me. I wouldn't. I've only written textbooks, you know, because I'm an academic. But I had Stephen Constantine, who is a writer, and he just was able to take the material I gave him and put it into, I think, very nice flowing kinds of prose, I guess you'd call.
Yeah.
And that was fun to have a colleague to work with.
Great. Well, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you today, Dr. Anne Wilbert-Burgess. Thank you so much for answering all the questions. If listeners want to get a copy of the book, it's called A Killer by Design, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. Anne, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.